the tactics and methods by which the Bolshevik Party were able to win over the majority of the working class, of the population, in 1917 and carry through the first socialist revolution in history. And I have to perhaps apologize because I am going to quote a lot from Lenin, mainly because I think it's important that the comrades hear firsthand what Lenin had to say about events. Because in preparing for this particular meeting, I reread, or at least I skimmed through, reread would be a bit of a tall order, the two volumes of correspondence, of collected correspondence and writings of Lenin in 1917, which I think should be made available as far as possible to as many comrades as possible, because it's a real eye-opener to see the real events and how Lenin was able to orientate towards them, how he explained them, and how he used them in order to build the influence of the Bolshevik Party. Now, of course, this is not an academic discussion, it's a means of training and learning from the past in order to be able to cope with the mighty tasks that will face us in the future. After all, we're in a period of profound instability on a world scale. You could say one of the most unstable periods in history. And in the next period, this will be intensified with not only wars, regional wars, but revolutions and counter-revolutions. And those processes will affect not only Latin America, which is the high point, if you like, of revolutionary development at the present time, but also Western Europe, and it will also affect Britain as well. And therefore, we have to understand that these lessons will have applications for our particular work in the coming period. Of course, the change from one social system to another is carried out by revolution, whereby power is transferred from one class to another class, from an old ruling class whose historical role has been exhausted to a new class which has history and has the future really in front of it. But of course, unlike processes and revolutions in nature and in nature as a whole, revolutions in society are carried through by individuals, and that's the big difference. Nevertheless, these individuals who carry through revolutions are not free agents. They have to carry through revolutions under the context in which they live, under the context of all the previous periods that have gone before them, which tends to limit their particular role and prescribes a certain road or path that they have to take. And that is why you can say that revolutions have their own laws. It's precisely because of this context that they have to be carried out in, that they have a certain law. And each revolution has similarities as well as they have differences. But the similarities are important for us from the point of view of understanding what revolutions are, how they come about, and how they have become successful. Because obviously the last 100 years has been full of revolutions. Unfortunately, the vast bulk of them have been unsuccessful, have been defeated. There's only one occasion whereby we had a successful revolution and introduced workers' democracy, and that was in Russia in 1917, and that's why it's of particular importance, and that's why we say the Russian Revolution was probably the most important event in history, whereby it proved in reality how the workers could come to power, the peasants, supported by the poor peasants. They could sweep away the rulers of the landlords and the capitalists and establish a society run by themselves. And that was the first time in history, apart from the episode of the Paris Commune in 1871. So it's a very important lesson, or lessons are are to be learned from this particular event. Now, revolutions are characterized in the popular jargon as like very quick events. The revolution takes place, a very quick thing, and they portray it as something violent and so on and so forth. Well, nothing could really be further from the truth. A revolution takes place over a number, or can take place over weeks, over months, and over years. The Spanish Revolution, for instance, unfolded over 7 years. So that shows how, and then within that revolution, there are ups and downs, there are periods of reaction and revolution. But it's a process, a contradictory dialectical process that unfolds in society because of the contradictions that are built up in society itself. It's objective reasons why revolutions take place. It's not because people want them or wish for them, but they occur because of the contradictions deep in society itself. And, of course, they culminate, don't they? They culminate, that's the whole point. A revolution has to culminate in the success or otherwise of a class. If it doesn't, it will be defeated. That's why the revolution in Venezuela, which you could say has unfolded at least since 1998, probably you can see 1989 with the Caracaso. That was the beginning, really, of the revolution in Venezuela. It's ups and downs and flows and so on. You could probably trace it back to that particular year. It's a very long period of time it involved in. And yes, the revolution is not finished. It can only finish when one class displaces the other class, when capitalism is broken and the working class become the ruling class in society. That is on the cards, that is a possibility that we have. Of course, it has to be brought into fruition. And therefore, we have to look at revolutions in order to study from them the most important lessons we can learn. In the Great History of the Russian Revolution by Leon Trotsky, which I should be over here, he opens up his preface by saying that the revolution can be characterized when the mass come onto the scene of history. When the masses, who were not involved in politics ever previously, become politicized and try to take destiny into their own hands. That reflects a revolution taking place. Of course, the culmination of the revolution is where that qualitative change takes place. Where, as I said, one class is replaced by another class in relation to ruling society. And that can happen in a very short space of time. And is a very conscious act. And it's a conscious act of a party. A party built up by the working class over a period of time, able to lead the working class, which culminates in the actual coming to power of the working class itself. And therefore, the role of the revolutionary party is also indispensable in the role of in the development of the revolution itself. It culminates. It's the most conscious expression of the revolutionary movement. And that was the role, basically, of the Bolshevik Party during 1917 itself. If the Bolshevik Party did not exist in 1917, then it's unlikely that a revolution would have been successful. That's how important it is. Therefore, we have to understand the relationship between the class, the party, and the leadership, which are also very important links in the development of the revolutionary movement itself. Of course, why did the revolution break out in Russia in 1917? In a very backward country, one of the most backward semi-feudal country you had in Europe. After all, didn't Marx say that the revolution was likely to break out in the most advanced industrial countries, where capitalism and capitalist relations were the most advanced, and the working class was the most strongest? Well, he said, in effect, that the revolution would be begun by the French workers, as the most revolutionary workers, that they'd be followed by the British workers, and the revolution would be consolidated by the German workers. He didn't think about the Russian workers, didn't come into the equation whatsoever. And that is an important element in an understanding of the Russian Revolution itself. So it's a dilemma. Why doesn't it correspond to the original idea that Marx had? Well, because of the complicated, the complex development of capitalism on a world scale. And to put it in a nutshell, let's make it simple, in the words of Lenin, the chain of capitalism, the international chain of capitalism, broke at its weakest link. That's the explanation. And the reason for that is because of the contradictory development of capitalism in Russia itself. It was a very backward country on the one hand, semi-feudal relations, you had the rule of the Tsar and Tsarism for 1,000 years. The population, the vast bulk of the population were peasants and lived on the land. The working class was very small. The industrial working class in Russia was something like 4 million if you included transport workers. And yet they led 100 million peasants and conquered power. But the reason for that was because of the condensed development of capitalism in a period of after the turn of the century, whereby imperialism, imperialist powers, France, Germany, Britain and other countries invested their capital in Russia, in big modern manufacturing industries, in Petrograd, Moscow and elsewhere, and where workers were taken straight from the village into industry. They had no conservative views or history to hold them back, and like that with the British worker, with a 200-year history of the trade unions, political parties, craft unions, all sorts of things. Whereas in Russia, things happened overnight, basically, with the emergence of this small but very compact working class, open to revolutionary ideas at that particular moment. Also, we have this peculiarity of what was the revolution, what was the character, the class character of the revolution that was going to take or should take place in Russia. And the Lenin and the Bolsheviks and also the Mensheviks, when they were in one organization, the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party, had the view, well, everybody had the view on the left, that the coming revolution was a bourgeois revolution. Unlike in Britain and France and Germany and so on, which had their bourgeois revolutions earlier, the Russian capitalists had come on the scene very late, by the way. They were very small, they were very feeble, and they were also very enmeshed with the old ruling class itself. They had investments on the land, the banks that owned land, into intermarriage and so on and so forth. The bourgeoisie in Russia, the weak Russian ruling bourgeois class, which didn't have political power, by the way. Political power in Russia rested with the nobility, with the aristocracy of the old feudal classes, right up until 1917. And the idea is you needed a bourgeois revolution to put the bourgeois in power to open the way for a capitalist development in Russia. But the problem was that the bourgeoisie in Russia wasn't a revolutionary class. It played a counter-revolutionary role. It had come on the scene too late. This is, and that applies to all the backward countries, if you like, or third world countries, whatever, underdeveloped countries at the present time. The bourgeoisie has come onto the scene too late. It's linked to imperialism. It's linked to the landlords. It doesn't want to carry through a revolution because it comes into conflict with its allies, who are the bulwark against revolution. And what Lenin understood is, yes, okay, we have a bourgeois revolution, but which class would lead that revolution? And he said the only revolutionary class existing in Russia was the proletariat, the working class, and the poor peasants, the peasantry. And therefore he came up with this idea that the slogan that should be put forward would be the democratic dictatorship of proletariat and peasantry, which is a little bit amorphous, because what is the balance then between the peasantry and the working class within this dictatorship, this government? Because the peasantry are not all the same. The peasantry is not homogeneous. You have your rich and exploited peasants, the kulaks, who own land, who exploit other peasants. You have the middle peasantry, which owns a bit of land and it's sustainable and so on and so forth. Then you have the vast bulk of the peasants, who if they own their land cannot survive on it and have to work for other peasants, the rich peasants and so on. So even within the peasantry there's a class division, isn't there? And the poorer peasants are allied to the working class. So that was the kind of dilemma and the dispute that they had. The Menshiks, on the other hand, had the perspective, the bourgeois revolution, the working class must support the bourgeoisie to carry out, right? So if the bourgeoisie a counter-revolution, that's a bit of a problem, isn't it? And that's what the debates that took place at that time in the Russian movement sort of were centered around. And Trotsky came forward with a position similar to Lenin, that the bourgeoisie was counter-revolutionary, similar to Lenin, that the working class were revolutionary. But the problem was, he said, well, his formulation would be the working class comes to power, supported by the poor peasantry, carries through the bourgeois democratic tasks, but does not stop there and proceeds to the socialist tasks themselves. It doesn't stop there because you cannot have this remaining in Russia, which is a very backward country, the beginning of the world revolution, the world socialist revolution. And those are the differences between Lenin, the Mensheviks and Trotsky prior to the 1917 revolution. Now, of course, a lot has been said about the 1917 revolution, particularly in bourgeois books in the universities and so on, in order to distort and to cover up the real lessons of what really happened in 1917. They don't want this to come out. Therefore, they describe the 1917 revolution, October that is, as a coup, as the Bolsheviks seizing power and under Lenin's leadership as a very authoritarian man and so on and so forth. And this prepared the way for Stalin and all the rest of it. And therefore, that's why socialism is a terrible thing, you know, that kind of idea. From our point of view, obviously we reject that kind of nonsense and look at things in a very scientific manner, understand what happened, and clarify what happened. But in doing so, we have to look up particularly the tactics, which is very illuminating, and the methods that the Bolsheviks used in order to win the majority of the working class and come to power in October 1917. After all, the Bolshevik Party, in February 1917, was a very small organization, about 8,000 members. They were a bit surprised about the revolution taking place, since that Lenin gave a lecture in January 1917. He was in exile in in Switzerland. And he gave a lecture to the young socialists, the Swiss young socialists, who he said, I don't think I'll see socialism in my time. I won't see the revolution. And it'll be you young generation will see the revolution. And yet within a matter of 1 month, the Tsar will be overthrown, and you see the beginning of the Russian Revolution. Mainly because Lenin was a bit out of touch from events. He wasn't in Russia, didn't have the full information of what was going on, and therefore could not appraise the actual situation concretely. Now, from our point of view, Marxism is a science, a very important science. It's a method of analysis, and we treat that very, very seriously. And when we read the writings of Marx or Engels or Lenin or Trotsky, our main task is to understand their method, to find out what Marxism is, how it applies itself, and so on and so forth. So we're looking for the method of Marxism, because Marxism is not a kind of gospel where every word that Lenin said on every occasion must be right, because he said certain things at different times, and different things on other occasions, which can be correct under certain circumstances. So you always have to see the context in which people are speaking, on which the Marxist writers are writing, if you want to understand them. So you don't treat them in some way as a kind of biblical text, unless he quoted some kind of cookbook for a revolution, or he was picking out quote marks and that's it. Obviously some so-called Marxists try and do that, which is just a lot of, doesn't get you anywhere, it's sterile. You must understand the method of Marxism in order to be able to apply it also to a new situation like today. So that's why we read Marx, we read Lenin, we read Trotsky, in order to understand the method, to learn from that. And I would say the writings that Lenin has in 1917 are brilliant. They are brilliant writings. And they should be made available to all comrades. Of course, as I said, Lenin, you can read Lenin in one period and read him another, and he can say even the opposite things. Because it depends on the situation you're in. And 1917, his writings in 1917, are probably a great example of this, where we have to look at the method, where he changed things, how he changed them, why he changed things, and how he looked at certain events. And the reason why I say this is because, well, particularly the people on the outer left, the sectarian groups and so on, tend to see things in very black and white terms. Revolution and real revolution, as Ted used to say. The more blood there is, the more violent something is, then that's the real revolution. These people are a caricature of a caricature of a caricature, really. And they tend to get their quotations, they get the incantations, they really are, from Lenin, from the period 1914 to 1917. And there's a reason for this. Clearly, 1914 was a major event in the history of the Marxist movement, where in August 1914, the social democratic leaders of the parties of the Second International betrayed the working class and basically led their workers into the World War of 1914-1918. After all the resolutions, all the talk in the previous period, opposing imperialism, opposing war, all that was thrown out the window, and they capitulated and went over to their ruling classes and supported the World War. And that was a betrayal of the workers and a betrayal of international socialism. And Lenin, from the word go, came out and opposed that line. So did Rosa Luxemburg, so did Trotsky. The internationalists of the world, John McLean in Scotland, of James Connolly in Ireland, the internationalists stood out against this betrayal of socialism. And Lenin wrote some very harsh words, as you can imagine, against the leaders who betrayed the movement. And they're also pretty harsh because he was directing those arguments and those ideas and those articles and those speeches precisely not to the mass of workers, who would never get to read them, but to the cadres, to the small groups of people he could come across, not only in Russia but elsewhere, to inoculate them against chauvinism, to reinforce the ideas of genuine Marxism, of internationalism, and against the world war, against class collaboration. All the fundamental ideas he came up with in a very sharp way, quite correctly, in order to clearly define what Marxism was, as opposed to those who sold out and who betrayed the working class and also called themselves Marxists. But you have to understand that, again, Lenin was not speaking to the mass of workers. He was speaking to tiny groups of people. He was speaking to the cadres. And that's why he adopted a very harsh language, and he could say he bent the stick, over, right? Bent the bit too far in order to make it crystal clear where he stood. Even those writings will come, even Ted used to say, but Lenin was a little bit ultra left, in that period, 1914 to 1917. But again, that is the reason. Bent the stick a bit too far. Why? To make sure that the cadres, the individual small groups, knew exactly what the line, the demarcation was between reformism and revolution, basically. And you get the ultra left sect who go, oh, this is fantastic. They get all this, you know, sort of revolutionary phraseology. They love it. You know, denouncing and denouncing you and all the rest of it. And they live for this because they think this is really revolutionary stuff. But they misunderstood really what Lenin was doing at that time. They didn't understand the context in which Lenin was writing. And you have to compare also Lenin's writing in other periods in order to understand the method of Lenin, if you're going to learn anything from it and not merely be a parrot and just speak and just repeat exactly what he said without understanding why or where or when he said it. Of course, these ultra-left also, because they are wild, right? But wild, they play to the hands of the ruling class, you know, yes, revolution's got to be bloody, yes, got to be violent and all the rest of it. Which has nothing to do with Marxism, and nothing to do with Bolshevism, and nothing to do with Lenin or Trotsky. On the contrary, we, as a Marxist tendency, always understood the question of violence, and we always understood that no ruling class in history has ever given up its power and privileges without a struggle. No doubt about it. Whether it be in Britain, whether it be in America, or Germany, or Russia, or anywhere else. And Marx even said that the revolution is the midwife, if you like, or violence is the midwife of the old society pregnant with the new society. This is a generalization which is absolutely correct. However, there's one thing understanding that the ruling class will never get up out of the struggles, another thing, are we in favour of a violent revolution? Are we in favour of a peaceful revolution? Of course, unless you're completely nuts, we're in favour of a completely peaceful revolution where the ruling class gives in to the majority of people who want change in society. You know, what else? And if they do that, that'll be fine. That'll be fine. But we also have to warn the ruling class has never done this in the past. And it needs to be, we need to prepare the movement to resist the sabotage of the capitalists, of the ruling class, and prepare to struggle if we need be. But such is the strength of the working class, if it was mobilized at the present time, in any country, it could paralyze the ruling class. And you could have a peaceful revolution, which we are in favor of course. But of course the sectarians are keen for the rivers of blood, the bloodier the better and so on and so forth, which again plays into the hands of the ruling class and say, yeah, exactly, because they always come out with this myth, you know, that revolutions are bloody, revolutions are violent, that's why you don't have revolutions. And that's what that is their propaganda they use day in and day out in order to frighten people, frighten the middle classes, frighten people in general, away from the ideas of revolution. That is, the change in society from one system to another. Of course, as I said, we warn the workers, but it's good to look at 1917 as a concrete example, isn't it, of how the Bolsheviks, as a Marxist party, saw things, and how it contrasts with the ultra-left and the sectarians, as a matter of fact. And it's something we can all learn from for the future itself. We must recall that the main struggle, first of all, this is a PS, in the PS 1914-1917, in the middle of the war, the First World War, Lenin did come up with some very harsh expressions, very, very, very bold expressions, you might say, you know, turned the imperialist war into a civil war, right? In other words, he was saying, let's end the war and turn it into a war between classes, but he used this phrase. Turn the imperialist war into a civil war. He also raised the idea it is better for the defeat of our own ruling class than it is the defeat of the enemy. In other words, he was trying to, again, bend the stick to say, we are internationalists, we have no country. We are workers of the world, unite. Our brothers are the workers in other countries, not the ruling class. And he put things in a very, very sharp way. Again, not for the mass, but for the cadres, for the small groups he could get to, to sharply pose things in a way that they would not, they'd see things crystal clear. But it was that kind of terminology, as I said, which is taken up by the ultra-left, who then think that this is a universal panacea to solve all problems. And they come forward on all sorts of occasions, one after another. Whereas, 1917 and the campaign of the Bolshevik Party to win the majority of the working class was never, ever done on the basis of those slogans. Those slogans were left alone. Those ideas were left alone. The main slogans that the Bolshevik Party used was bread, land, and peace. And all power to the Soviets. Those are the main demands that the Bolshevik used to win over the masses in Russia in 1917. Not turn the imperialist war into a civil war. They didn't have people shouting about that. But they tried to link their experience, their ideas with the experience of the masses themselves. And that is all. That's what Lenin. That's not the greatness of Lenin, the greatness of Marxism, if you like, in attempting to understand the need to win a majority of the working class to your side. You can't have a revolution with a minority. You can only have a revolution when the masses support you, when the majority of the working class, the majority of the population, support you in your endeavour to pursue a revolution itself. So Lenin, in 1917, was far less radical, if you like, than he was in previous years. Very moderate, if you like, in his language, in order to understand he was now talking to the masses. He was now talking to the people at large. And therefore, they had to gain their ears. You can't go by and shout them from the rooftop, because no one's going to listen to you. You have to gain the ear and echo amongst the masses themselves, of the workers themselves, taking up their problems. And therefore there are many examples by which Lenin attempted to do this. But let's go back to one little problem which is worth looking at in 1917, was that there is an idea, mainly put forward by the Stalinists, that the communists, the Bolshevik Party under Lenin, from February 1917 to October 1917, simply unfurled its banner and won over everybody, and that was the end of it. No problem on it. Slightly more complicated, obviously, than that. I don't know if it's a bit too simplistic. But the reason being that Lenin had to wage a war, his own war, inside his own party. And the reason for that is there's always a tendency in a party and in an organization to have its own routine, its own routinism. But when the situation breaks, you have to change your routine. You have to adapt to a new, fundamentally different situation. And February 1917 was exactly that. The February Revolution was a fundamental break in the history of Russia, in the history of the world, for that matter. And the Bolshevik Party and Lenin had to recognize what had happened and orientate it very quickly. And he had to reorientate the party, the Bolshevik Party, because it was living with slogans that it had inherited from the past. And one of the big slogans was, as I earlier remarked, that was this idea of let's go for a dictatorship, a democratic dictatorship of proletariat and peasantry, which is a very kind of bit woolly, if you like, algebraic formula, which led to confusion in 1917. Because that slogan led a number of the Bolshevik leaders, Stalin, Kamenev and others, to think they should support the provisional government, the government that came, that arose out of the revolution in 1917, a bourgeois government. That they should support that, because isn't this the dictatorship that we've talked about, of workers and peasants and so on and so forth? And Lenin had to go into the Bolshevik Party saying, no, comrades. Don't treat Marxism as a dogma, and it's quite, I don't want to quote it here, we haven't got enough time, but don't treat the party program as a dogma. We have to look at the real situation. We have to understand what is the reality on the ground and not what we'd like it to be. We have to take a turn in this situation. We have to recognize this is the beginning of the Russian Revolution. In fact, this famous rearming of the party took place in April, at the April conference. And Lenin's opening shots, while he was in Switzerland, as a matter of fact, was to write a thesis called the April Thesis, which is, there's an article in the journal a couple of months ago about it, which said, hang on, this is a fundamental turning point. We have to understand that this government has come to power because the revolution took place on the 24th, 25th, 26th of February, resulted in the creation of Soviets, like it did in 1905, Soviets arose. But the people who dominated the Soviets were the parties, not the Bolsheviks, but were the Mensheviks and the Social Revolutionaries. The Social Revolution, in effect, were like a peasant party, and the Mensheviks were like the, well, they believed in the bourgeois revolution and give power to the bourgeoisie. So that was their perspective. And they gave support to the founding of a new government called the Provisional Government, which is made up of the bourgeois representatives. And the Soviets gave support to this provisional government. And Lenin was even in exile, wrote and said, no support in the provisional government. It is a capitalist government. We cannot support the capitalists. We cannot get any support to these people. We will not solve any of the problems confronting the peasantry or the national minorities or the workers. This government is an alien government and we have no support in it. Because some of the leaders are saying, well, can we give it a bit of support insofar as it does help, you know, give some support? I mean, Lenin is no way, no way. This is the wrong perspective. In fact, this government will not be able to solve the problems. And we have to look for a new revolution. And some of the Bolshevik Party, what the hell? You know, well, Lenin's become a Trotskyist or something, you know, because there were big disputes with Trotsky in the previous 15 years. And that, incidentally, Trotsky was in America at the time, or in exile at this time, wrote a similar idea, the need for this first revolution, as it was, put the bourgeois government into power, but it was going to lay the basis for a new revolution. So Lenin and Trotsky's ideas coincided, although they were thousands and thousands of miles apart, on the basis of an understanding of the revolution, the mechanics of the revolution, and what role should the working class and the Bolshevik parties have at that particular moment. So this old slogan was thrown aside by Lenin. He said, no, the new one now, all power to the Soviets. The Soviets were, he said, this situation in Russia in 1917, in February 1917, April 1917, March, April, is a period of dual power. Dual power. Where on the one hand, the workers had set up these Soviets, these committees, which are delegates from the factories. Later on, peasants, Soviets, and soldiers, Soviets were set up. Committees, that's all it was. Revolutionary committees. Which were very, very democratic, because they had elected people on the basis of how many representatives you had in the factory. You could recall those people immediately. So it was a very democratic form of organization set up spontaneously by the working class, by working people. Lenin didn't call for it. The Bolsheviks never called for it. It just happened spontaneously as a result of the experience in 1905. And the setup of the Petrograd Soviet, where Trotsky was the chairman, if you remember, at that particular time. So these Soviets grew up, and they represented, in the words of Lenin, the future workers' government in Russia. On the other hand, you had the provisional government, which was made up of the capitalists. And they had formerly had power, because the people who led the Soviets were, in the words of Lenin and Trotsky, were compromisers. They were the social revolutionaries and the Mensheviks. They had the majority. And why did they have the majority? Because the masses took the line of least resistance. These parties had the more intellectuals, the more well-known figures, and so on and so forth. And the workers and the masses, who after all have been kind of deluded, because the war occurred. We're in the middle of a war here. And the army played a role in this revolution. The army was made up mainly of peasants. So they deleted things as well, and they were sending representatives from them, the social revolutionary representatives who had been sent to these committees. So the compromises in the first stages of the revolution, the Social Revolutionary Party and the Mensheviki Party had the majority. The Bolsheviks were a tiny minority within the Soviets. But they recognized that this was the embryo of a future workers' power. And that's why they wanted to bring down the provisional government at a certain stage and replace it with a Soviet government based on these committees, based on a new type of state, which you heard this morning, the new state like the Paris Commune of 1871, which Lenin Engels, Engels asked, where is the workers' state then? And Engels said, there's your workers' state. Paris, 1871, the workers had come to power. They had power in their hands, they elected their representatives, the right to recall and so on and so forth, which Marx describes in his writings. But what I'm getting at is that Lenin had to rearm the party. And in the April conference was where he did it. And this is one of his speeches that he gave at the conference. In the 19th century, Marx and Engels, following the proletarian movements in various countries, and analysing the possible prospects for social revolution, repeatedly stated that the roles would, in general, be distributed among those countries in proportion to and according with the historically conditioned national features. They expressed their idea briefly. The French worker will begin, the German worker will finish. The great honour of beginning a revolution has fallen to the Russian proletariat, says Lenin. But the Russian proletariat must not forget that its movement and revolution are only part of a world revolutionary proletarian movement. In other words, Lenin had no, from the word go, Lenin had no idea or conception or thought that Russia would be a socialist country. Because of the backwardness, it was impossible. But it could begin a revolution. And that revolution could spread throughout the world. And the war, the world war, were precisely creating conditions, together with the crisis of capitalism, conditions for the spread of world revolution. So the Russian Revolution was the beginning of the world revolution. That's the way Lenin and the Bolsheviks looked at this particular question. Of course, he says, this is in April 1917, the provisional government must be overthrown, but not now, and not in the usual way. We'll go into that in a minute. It's quite interesting. And he goes on, so someone in the party conference says, what about the socialists? They can't have socialism in Russia, for God's sake. His comrade Rykov says that socialism must come from other countries with a more developed industry. But that is not so, says Lenin. Nobody can say who will begin and who will end it. That is not Marxism, that is a parody of Marxism. In other words, look at the reality it is. Look at the real situation. The Russians have begun it. We won't end it, but we've begun it. Marx said that France would begin it and Germany would finish it. But the Russian proletariat has achieved more than anybody else. So he's looking at the real situation that is unfolding. At the April conference he did say also, a resolution was put. To put the issue of socialism not as a jump, but as a practical way out of the present debacle. This is a bourgeois revolution. It is therefore useless to speak of socialism, say our opponents. But we say just the opposite. Since the bourgeoisie cannot find a way out of the present situation, the revolution is bound to go on. We must not confine ourselves to democratic phrases. We must make the situation clear to the masses and indicate a number of practical measures to them. Namely, they must take over the syndicates, control them through the Soviets. When all such measures are carried out, Russia will be standing at one foot in socialism. The beginning. So that was attacked in April 1917. The Bolsheviks' leadership were a bit shaken because they never realized this was going to be the perspective, because the last 17 years they've been arguing a different perspective. And it was Trotsky, actually, in 1905, who came forward with this idea of the permanent revolution. That the working class would come to power and would carry out the bourgeois democratic task and then proceed to the socialist task. And 1917 was a confirmation of the permanent revolution. It also really represents the coming over of Lenin to Trotsky's position on the revolution. In his own way, in a different route, coming over, drawing similar conclusions to Trotsky itself.